Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. The number of murders in Charlotte at the halfway point of 2019 has eclipsed the total for 2018. Most of the murders are being committed by people under the age of 25 who know their victims. This escalating problem has long been a point of frustration for CMPD Chief Kirk Putney, who has pleaded for the community's help in getting a handle on what he views as a community health issue. He's also augmented foot patrols and put additional police elsewhere on the streets in trouble-prone areas. But he also blames the criminal justice system for reasons he will explain for the remainder of this hour. Kirk Putney joins us along with Mecklenburg County District Attorney Spencer Merriweather, who has also said that our city's criminal justice system is overburdened because the area's population has outstripped the system's capacity. Thank you both for being here. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Welcome. Chief, let me begin with you because the number keeps changing, so I'll ask you for the latest official count of the number of homicides so far this year in the city.
Yes, currently we're at 63 victims.
Over the weekend, it was 58. Is that right?
Just 59? Going into the going into the weekend of 58.
Put that into perspective. That seems like it seems to jump in leaps and bounds like this every once in a while. But is that how it happens around the country, or is it particular to Charlotte?
It is not particular to Charlotte, and numbers change from year to year. I can assure you, next year is going to be lower. The year before was lower. This year is higher. It goes up and down. But the problem is, a loss of life is a loss of life, and I don't think a number does it justice.
And not just, and that's something you keep stressing, this is not just a bullet going through somebody and killing them. It's families, it's the community at large being impacted.
Absolutely.
By this. Rising violent crime is also rising at the same time as the number of homicides is rising. Is there a connection in your mind, Spencer Merriweather?
Well, certainly. Wherever there is violent crime, particularly wherever there is engagement involving firearms, the incidence of violent crime will go up, and yes, the incidence of homicide will go up as well. Quite frankly, the way that you combat homicide really has to be the way that you combat violence altogether. Part of the problem that we're facing as a community is that people are so quick to move to acts of violence. We can talk about policies all day long. We can talk about practices all day long. But at the end of the day, it's really about changing the way that people respond to one another.
That's what's driving this. The fact that people are too quick to use a gun to solve a problem.
Yeah, the fact that people are quick to resort to violence instead of talking it out.
How do you explain that? What's happened?
Well, it's been a series of things over time, actually. A loss of civility.
Being driven from the top down.
Well,
you said that, not us.
I'll say it again.
It permeates the whole country. It's part of the social fabric. It seems that we're fraying in the area of civility, and it's costing us lives on the back end because now people are filling that void with violence.
Was I correct when I said that most of the murders are being committed by people under the age of 25 who know their victims?
Absolutely.
How many of these are being being committed by people who have previous records that should have raised red flags and should maybe have put them out of our reach, out of the reach of a gun or out of the reach of a person they might do harm to?
Not a majority, but a significant number. People say, well, what are you going to do about crime? What are you going to do about homicides? And the truth is that it's real hard to remove criminal intent from someone's heart. That said, you do know that if there are people who have demonstrated a risk, that is something that you feel like you can do something about. That is something that you feel as if you can give some attention to. And I think that any of us who are working in criminal justice at all, would be derelict in our duty if we weren't giving some additional attention to those things that we can do something about. And demonstrated risk is one of those things.
And we're also going to talk about some of the other things you'd like to see done and that are, in fact, being done to address this. But you've called this, Chief Putney, a community health issue and the one that cannot be solved by police alone. Do others in power, do others in the community see it that way? And are you getting any feedback from the community in terms of, because you've said people aren't coming forward. They know things, they won't tell you, they can't help you if they don't tell you. So, sure. And they can't help themselves if they don't tell you. So is that happening?
Well, it's on two fronts. The community is stepping up in some ways. We're having quite a few partners who are working with us to teach conflict resolution, for instance. But the other piece of it is we still have quite a few people who are asleep who think this doesn't impact them. And I tell you, the loss of social capital impacts all of us as a city.
Yeah.
Because as the people go, so does the economy for the city, so does the bloodline of the city itself.
Explain that.
Well, if you have people who are afraid to come here and establish businesses, then obviously it's going to have an impact that impacts all of us as a community. So we got to get our hands around this, start to do the work now to plant seeds to break the cycle that leads to violence in the first place.
You've gotten on this program and in other arenas where you've spoken publicly about this, you've gotten pretty emotional about this from time to time, and by emotion I mean you're letting your frustration.
You don't have to qualify it, Mike. I know what you mean, and you're right.
The audience exactly may not know that your frustration has come through loud and clear with this. And I want to go back to something you said earlier in this program, and I'm going to paraphrase it. You said that if you just focus on the number of people who are dying because they're being shot, you're missing the point here.
Absolutely.
That you believe we should be focusing on the families devastated by this loss.
Without a doubt.
This is happening within a community, not just the Charlotte community at large, but within a community, a subset of Charlotte at large. And the people who are, because they know each other, they know the victims, the people who are committing these crimes see the impact of this on the community.
Sure.
Why isn't that having an effect on them?
As I said before, the lack of civility. We're seeing these people who are consistently committing violent crimes over and over again become quite calloused. And their only priority is to exert their will on others.
So why are they in a position to be able to repeat violent crimes over and over again?
Well, I have my opinion. I don't know that...
I'd like to hear it.
I'm sure you will. And I promise you will. I think our system is failing to hold those who are repeatedly most violent accountable. We talk about a risk assessment, but we have to then rally the whole system around holding those who constantly commit violent crime accountable so that they can't commit the crime that eventually leads to homicide.
And by holding them accountable, you mean?
Well, I've heard, I've been here for the 10-year, overlapped about the 10-year of three sheriffs, and all of them talk about vacancy rates. If there's a vacancy rate in jail, I want violent repeat offenders to take residence there. There's a reason that we're trying to take the most violent off the streets, because we know that way they can't reoffend and kill other people.
So how do they get there? How do we take those people off the streets and put them in those vacant jail cells that the sheriffs talk about, Spencer Merriweather? What's the process, and why doesn't it seem to be working?
Well, I do want to back up for a second, because I want to put this in proper perspective. When we talk about someone who's committed a crime on the street, when they're arrested, they have been accused of a crime.
Right, they're innocent until proven guilty.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about jail space, we are talking about people who are awaiting a trial. And the key behind putting that person in jail is not about the punishment. That's not what is going on at that time. It's about them awaiting their trial. But there is a question as to whether or not that person poses a risk to our community at large. And if someone, and I've used this litany a lot, if someone shoots somebody, shoots up a house, shoots up a car, sticks a gun in somebody's face, commits like a violent sexual assault,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't take a huge collection of knowledge to figure out that, yes, that person is likely to be a danger to the safety of the community. When we see that, the expectation should be that that person is held in custody. Now, again, it is a justice system, innocent until proven guilty. If there are things that we ought to do or if there are ways that we can better equip our justice system to make it so that that person sees a trial and we reduce the amount of time that they're in custody, let's get about that business.
We got a guy in jail in New York City, Jeffrey Epstein, who is accused of committing all kinds of sexual inappropriate sexual acts with minor women, minor children. And he is in jail at the moment because he poses a threat to the community and also a flight risk because he's a multimillionaire and he could leave the country in a drop of a hat. And he hasn't killed anybody. So if somebody has shot up a house, as you said, or shot up a car, even if they haven't killed someone, why isn't that automatically viewed as someone who poses as much of a threat to the community as Jeffrey Epstein?
Without speaking directly to a case that's pending somewhere, I will say that if someone is assaulting young children, I believe that's also a risk as well.
Is this a bone of contention between your department, the police department, and the criminal justice system? Not Spencer Merriweather personally, but just the way the courts run things?
No, I just think people got to understand we have different functions. And we come from the perspective of victims. I mean, we just do. And we also want to make sure that within our justice system, we're not only making sure people who will have their day in court, you know, show up to court, we also want to make sure that we weigh that against the need for protecting the public. And I don't think we have a big difference of opinion there. It's just how we get there that I think becomes the difficulty that we have to navigate.
How many people who are accused of a violent crime, I'm sure if you're, let me ask the first question first. If you're accused of murder, did they let you out on bail?
I would say that most people who are accused of murder in this county do get a bail, And I would say that in almost every case, we would prefer that they did not.
And why then, if you're the district attorney, who makes that decision, the judge?
Let me use this as an opportunity to relieve the community of the misconception that DA set bonds. We do not. We make arguments for bonds to judges, as do defense attorneys. Mm-hmm. But yes, it is the judicial official that either a magistrate or a superior court judge that sets a bond.
But then in America, you are innocent until proven guilty. So even if you have allegedly killed someone and the evidence is fairly convincing that you have done the deed, until the trial is over, you are innocent, correct?
Right, and it's not a guilt-innocence phase when we have a bond hearing.
So if you back down from that and it's just a violent crime, a robbery in which you used a gun but the gun did not go off, or you shot up the front glass of a store to break in, that would be a violent crime. But is your chance of getting out of or of getting bail greater in those instances even than it would be if you were accused of murder?
I'll say it this way. Sometimes those determinations are made within 60 seconds. That's wrong. The types of things that the chief is talking about those victims, we try to give victims that voice so that it's not just about the defendant that a judge is hearing about. It's about that victim who can give you the best indication of how the safety of the community will be threatened if that person is released.
So violent crime in general is up about 4% over last year. And Chief Butner, you said that repeat violent offenders play a role in that increase. You know that.
A major role, yes.
Do the courts know that?
Sure. Here's the deal.
Does it make a difference to the courts?
Well, the difficulty is people aren't very educated about how the system works.
Okay.
So you go from trying to make sure this, whoever the defendant is, the accused, has an opportunity to post bail and be out awaiting trial. I mean, that's a part of it because they haven't been convicted yet. We talked about that. My perspective, though, and I'm very narrowly focused on those repeat violent offenders who have, first they rob you with a gun, then they shoot at your car, and then they shoot at you, and lo and behold, amazingly, sometime down the road, they kill you. So I'm telling you, the escalating of violence is what we need to take more serious. So you go from robbing people to shooting at people, yeah, your likelihood for killing people dramatically increases, as should the opportunity to keep you in jail awaiting trial because you've shown a history of escalating violence.
And you've said until we get serious about repeat violent offenders, we're going to be dealing with violence as a city. Why aren't we serious? What would it take to get serious? And what would that look like if we did become serious about this?
It's two fronts. We're talking about a lot of systems, one of which is justice system. The other thing is, how do you instill in people that they have something to look forward to. It goes back to the school system as well, making sure we're not failing those who are most vulnerable. I mean, it's more complicated than just saying keep all people who've committed crime in jail. I wish it were that simple. It's not. And the investment has to be on the front end, which is why we spend so much of our time and effort diverting people out of the criminal justice system in the first place.
If you are accused of murder and you're out on bail, if you are accused of another violent crime and you're out on bail, are you simply free to roam, or are you put on a monitoring program of some sort, an ankle monitoring program? What happens to those people?
It can be that a person who is released is put on electronic monitoring, and that electronic monitoring, quite frankly, the district attorney's office will ask for it, and we're doing that as a last resort. Usually that the argument to the court is, Your Honor, if you intend to release this person, we would ask that you at least make a condition of electronic monitoring part of that release.
CMPD administers that program, the electronic monitoring program, and yet you have been critical of the program of electronic monitoring in general, or not maybe in specific cases, maybe not in general. And want to put words in your mouth.
Sure.
What did you mean by your negative view about electronic monitoring?
Well, we didn't want to get into this business in the first place. We just didn't. But there was a gap that we saw, and there was an opportunity, at least when you get out on bond, that we can tell where you've been. So if a crime is committed, we at least have an opportunity technologically to find some potential suspects. So I never said it didn't work. I just said it's not as effective as we'd like it to be in deterring crime.
So this is not like the dog collars you put on people, on dogs rather, that they go past the invisible fence and suddenly they get shocked. They can go beyond the boundaries of what you say,
sure,
but they're being tracked. Well, how quickly can you respond if they go beyond the boundaries?
A piece of it is there is what we call geofencing. So if it's like a domestic violence situation, we can put a boundary around, for lack of a better term, that residence. And then when they go near within a certain radius, there's a trigger that alerts us. But generally, you just have a device on and you're given a curfew. And if we find you in violation of that curfew, or as I said before, we have some offenses that are similar to the one that you committed, we can see where you've been to see if you're a potential suspect in those new crimes.
How often are people that you think ought to be in jail while they await trial, how often are they not? How often are they released on bail? How often are they put on electronic monitoring?
Well, certainly you've talked about murder cases in particular, and that is, you know, often there's a bond that's set, and we would wish there would not be. For a number of other violent offenses, as far as like percentages, I don't have those for you. But
so when judges go against the wishes of the district attorney or even the police and release these people on bail or put them on electronic monitoring, and you think they ought to be in jail, are they doing that simply because their hands are tied by laws they have to follow as judges, or are they doing this because they don't understand the situation we're facing in Charlotte-Mecklenburg?
They are making an assessment on safety and the likelihood of that person coming to court, just like the law calls on them to. They are also, quite frankly, looking at the strength of our evidence. And if the case looks as if it's not strong, then they'll make a decision to release that person.
Spencer Merriweather is the Mecklenburg County District Attorney. Kurt Putney is CMPD Chief. We will come back and talk more about the rising crime rate and what's being done about it and some ideas that they have about ways to change the system in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the rise in violent crime, the rise in homicides in Charlotte, and the increasing amount of frustration on the part of people in law enforcement and criminal justice to get a handle on the situation. Kurt Putney is with us. He's CMPD Chief of Police. And Spencer Merriweather is the Mecklenburg County District Attorney. We're going to have a special public conversation on Charlotte's rising homicide count and community-based solutions for addressing public safety on Tuesday evening, July 30th at 7:30 at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church. You can get details about that at WFAE.org. Before we talk about some ideas you have that might help this situation. Let me share with you a couple of emails that have come in. Kirby says, in addition to the lack of civility in society that the chief has been talking about, we're also seeing a lack of action to do something about guns. Kids are killed at school, adults are killed at work and church and in fast food restaurants. Nothing happens. Have we become too numb to violence to do anything?
Well, I can tell you from a law enforcement perspective, over the last few years, including this year, we continue to seize more weapons from people, mainly people who shouldn't have them. So the work is being exerted to change that. But I can tell you, every weapon we take from somebody, if they're not fully held accountable, they will get another weapon and continue to commit crime. So our officers are doing fantastic work. They're doing the work to seize these weapons, to take them out of the hands of those who shouldn't have them. But that doesn't mean they won't have the opportunity to rearm themselves illegally in the future.
So a comment. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I want to, we obviously do a lot of, negative talk about, where we are in the criminal justice system. But I also want to make sure that the people in the community know there are over 100 people who are repeat offenders who, have gone into custody and enhanced sentences as habitual felons just last year. That if you are convicted of possession of a firearm by a felon in this community, you will, go to prison. That you are there are people who are being held accountable for doing bad things to people every single day in this community. And I think the community deserves to have a level of confidence that, yes, when the law allows and when there is evidence to actually make a case, we'll make it. And we'll make sure that people are held accountable.
But is the law adequate for what we're facing in modern America today?
It can't just be the law. Quite frankly, it's also got to be the populace. It's got to be the community. The availability of guns, our quickness as a society to pick up a gun, to take a gun to certain places. We now are in a circumstance where, when I first started this job, you couldn't take a gun to a playground. You couldn't take a gun to a bar. You couldn't take a gun to a restaurant. And now we're in a different circumstance. And I think we're seeing some of the result of that.
You can take a gun to a restaurant?
Well, certain places, yeah.
Okay. From Facebook, they say it's a social issue, but also a gun issue. Local officials are refusing to address gun violence in our communities, and they are failing their constituents. Yeah, we have the Second Amendment. Is there anything you can really do?
I told you what we're doing. We're seizing more weapons now than ever. Our officers are putting their lives on the line to do just that. So if it were a law enforcement or just a justice system issue, would have solved it already. You also got to think about how we hold people accountable whose behavior is just outside of what we're willing to tolerate. You get what you tolerate. And right now what we're getting is we're allowing people who shouldn't have weapons to arm themselves and commit violent crime repeatedly
Who are the we that are allowing people to arm themselves who shouldn't have guns?
People who aren't calling. We have a firearm by felon initiative. If you call, we'll give you money through Crime Stoppers. If you're getting helping us get illegal firearms out of the hands of felons. So if you're aware that felons have guns, those who've been convicted of felonies, and they're armed, and you know they are, and they're out in the public, and you don't call, you're the we I'm speaking of.
Okay. Right now, Spencer, you report that, or CMPD reports, 20 homicide suspects are awaiting trial on electronic monitors. That figure may have changed since June 26, but that was the figure back then. How do you feel about that?
These are people, if I believe that someone killed someone, I believe that that's a person who should be in custody.
And we also, the last time you were here, we spoke extensively about altering the bail system so that it was more fair to people whose lives are irreparably, in many cases, damaged by not being able to make bail. Because once again, a lot of people in jail are there because they've been accused of something. They are not guilty until proven guilty. And yet their lives are irrevocably damaged by a lot of the old bail system, because money bail is difficult for a lot of people. So you've tried to make changes in that. Is that having a negative impact on what we're talking about this morning? Are more people able to make bail under this new system that really should be in jail?
I think some of the same questions that we face today about people who commit violent crimes, those things pre-existed a bail policy. And what the bail policy did do is it did create equity. It did make it so that if you were a poor person and you committed a particular crime, you had the same possibility of getting out as a rich person. And I think that's exactly what the Constitution requires. Mm-hmm. I think that's appropriate. I also think what is equitable, and I think what's appropriate, is that if you harm someone if you commit violence against someone, that whether you are a rich person or a poor person, you should not be released from custody. Plain and simple.
So it shouldn't be economic. I mean, it shouldn't be based on whether you can afford to get out. It should be based on the accusation of the level of the crime you're accused of committing.
And I don't want to, I don't want to oversimplify it. I should say that we've obviously got to put our evidence up. Right. We've got to make a case to the court, and then we will make a case to a jury on guilt and innocence. But if we have a substantial allegation that's backed up by facts and evidence that a person actually committed these sort of serious acts of violence, then yes, it's my expectation, be you rich or poor, that you don't threaten witnesses, so that there's not a chilling effect upon those people who we expect to come to court and testify and say, this person did this to me. Mr. DA, Your Honor, members of the jury, please hold this person accountable.
Right. From your point of view as a police officer, is this new bail system working for you?
I think there are some benefits to the new bail system. Nobody wants to have indigent people who are in jail awaiting trial just because they can't afford to get out. That's not the point. The point, though, that I'm making is, until we're holding repeat violent offenders accountable with bail system and everything else that we do, we're failing the public. Right. We have to be intentional about those who constantly commit violent crimes, and that's my focus right now, violent crime on victims of this community. Until we hold them completely accountable, I don't think any system's working as well as it should.
People will try to put you on these sides, and they'll try to make you feel as if safety and fairness are mutually exclusive. They are not. You can do both. All you have to do is apply some common sense to it. We walk out of the middle of 7th Street right now. I promise you, if you ask someone who should be in custody and who should not, right, and what sort of conditions would you apply, what's equitable, they will tell you.
Well, who applies the common sense? Who's charged with doing that?
I think that I've got a case to make, quite frankly. I think defense attorneys got a case to make. A judge has to have open ears. We have to give them the opportunity to have time to hear really substantive arguments from both sides. We have to make sure that victims are given a voice here.
Time is a word I've never heard until yesterday with regard to the criminal justice system, because it seems everybody has a right to a, quote, speedy trial, unquote. But on the other hand, these things tend to drag on for years in some cases. But time, I want to talk about time in a different framework, because you've talked about how we are stretched thin in the criminal justice system and in the court system. We don't have enough prosecutors. We don't have enough judges to handle the population of Charlotte or the population of the urban centers of North Carolina. And I read something yesterday, and I'm trying to find my note on this, about you say that our system in North Carolina is structured around an antiquated formula with judges that have one-week commissions to try cases. What does that mean?
So, and again, it's not necessarily about the number of personnel you have. It's about the structure. One-week commissions means this. We have judges that are assigned to Mecklenburg County for 6 months, but they're commissioned for a single set of court cases to hear within a week. And let's say they're assigned to criminal court. It's 1 week. So if I have someone who's assigned to court and they hear a breaking and entering trial that lasts 3.5 days, they may be reluctant to start a case involving a habitual felon that may take 4 days because their commission will be up before they're done. So that means 1.5.
What does that mean, their commission will be up?
That means that the amount of time that they're assigned to criminal court is over.
So if they find themselves in the middle of a case and their commission is up, what happens?
It will run over,
yeah,
and then they're done. And most times judges will try to find a way not to run over into the next week because of the system that we have. It causes a flurry all across the state.
So who designed the system and why?
It just was designed at a time where I believe people were still what they call riding circuit, which actually referred to
horseback riding.
Exactly.
So we haven't changed the system for 100 and some years. Clearly we need to. Who's in charge of that?
Well, I think clearly the legislature makes the law. Administrative Office of the Courts is in charge of our court system.
Politicians love to yell about violent crime.
Yeah.
Why aren't they, if this will help solve the problem, why aren't they interested in this? Or are they and just don't know about it?
Well, it takes strategy and it takes investment. And quite frankly, there's a lot of priorities that we have across the state. Spending money on the courts is something that, it's sort of boring. It's a boring way to spend money, but quite frankly, it's extremely important. I just drove back into Charlotte at 2:30 last night coming back from a prosecutor's conference, and people look at me and they hear about the struggles that we have, and they can't believe it because the 16th largest city in the country is facing problems where we have three criminal courts going at one time, and everyone else thinks that's nuts.
You have, what, 80-some prosecutors right now? You need 115.
115 would put us equal to most jurisdictions our size, yes.
Okay, and our size is 1.1 million, so
right.
115 prosecutors. And also, you say, how many judges do we need?
Well, we need more. How about that? Right now, we're able to run three Superior Court courtrooms, and that's with three judges. And if we doubled it, we'd be in good shape.
You have 215 defendants with cases pending on your homicide team. You've taken 8 homicides to trial so far this year.
And we're in court with 9 right now.
And there are 20 homicide suspects awaiting trial on electronic monitors. So that means you can't handle all the homicide cases in the course of a single year. Is that right?
That's definitely right.
Sure.
What role does that play in encouraging the perception on the part of troublemakers that they can get away with it because it's not going to come to trial?
Obviously, that's a perception that many have, especially those who are out on electronic monitoring. Again, I challenge us as a system to look at what we're saying to victims. We have 20-plus people who are still out on the street, who didn't finish, who, you know, might have killed somebody in your family. It's kind of hard to reconcile those kinds of things for some of our victims.
12 people out on electronic monitoring have been arrested this year. That means they were out, they had the ankle bracelet on, and you still had to re-arrest them.
Yes.
Because either they cut it off or they did something while wearing the monitor. Were they still wearing the monitor, most of these people?
Many times, no. But sometimes the battery dies. Here's the deal. And this is with us giving opportunity after opportunity to fix minor issues like the battery going dead and so forth. So those are those that more intentionally we're trying to subvert the technology of the electronic monitors.
Getting back to the bail system, you had a meeting with the chief magistrate, the architect of this new bail policy, and the chief district judge as well about that policy. And you came away, Chief Putney, saying that we have a lot more in common in the area of repeat violent offenders. What are the areas of agreement that you found?
Is very consistent is we all know we all have to do better at holding those repeat violent offenders accountable because the vast majority of us actually live in this jurisdiction. We have family members here, and it is personal. Unfortunately, the law makes you put that aside, but ultimately, we know the expectation of the public, which is why I keep saying equal accountability, the expectation of the public has to be met as well, which is balancing, making sure somebody comes to court, and ensuring public safety.
Both of you have agree on the efficacy of what are called diversion programs. Chief Putney, you've talked about the youth diversion program.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Merriweather, you've talked about criminal diversion programs. Are they one and the same? Do they work? How do they work?
Yes, yes.
Why do they work?
and the why. Well, yes, if you are able to intervene with we talk about, let's start with the homicides. You know, what it takes to actually put in your heart to take someone's life, if you can get at that early, sometimes that takes years of development. If I can reach out to a child when they're 13, 14 years old and actually forming values and take them off of a trajectory of criminal behavior, I have done something in that child's life, and there's no telling how many lives I've actually saved. What sort of impact you can have on an entire community by diverting someone in a comfortable way. The chief does it every day. Law enforcement does it every day. These are great investments in our neighborhoods, great investments in safety. And yes, it gives people the early second chance that they need to turn their entire life around.
You know, every time one of these incidents happens, it's usually by a young person. And my first thought is they've ruined their life. I mean, if they haven't died at the hands of the police because they didn't drop the gun, they're going to go to jail. And they're going to go to jail for a long time, many of them. And if they get out of jail, they're going to have a tough time in the world. So,
just for the record, only 2 didn't drop the gun this year versus 63.
Okay.
So I'm just saying, let's put it into context, too. So I think the bigger threat is the fact that we have repeat violent offenders who are escalating their violence and preying on victims in our community.
So in these diversion programs, do you talk about how that split-second decision is going to change your life forever?
Choices and consequences, absolutely. We preach it all the time, choices and consequences. And here's what's amazing to me is we're turning around hundreds of lives every year, 90 of whom never commit another crime. And reach out. These are people who did their first nonviolent felony. And we walk them through the whole process with the DA's office up to expungement. Only one out of 100 has ever committed another crime. It works.
Are people listening to you and your pleas for a change in the way we approach this at the courts and the number of people needed for the courts?
I believe they are, yes.
They are. And are people listening to you in the community when you're asking them to come forward and help you? Is that happening?
We shall see. Some are, but not quite enough.
Chief Kurt Putney from CMPD, Spencer Merriweather is the Mecklenburg County District Attorney. Thank you both for being here. Appreciate it.
Sir.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.